call the meeting back to order. Okay, we've got a big, important item on the agenda next, which is number 8, 2013-14 sport fishing rule proposals. This is a briefing, but it's also a public hearing. And we have Craig Burley, our Fish Management Division Manager, Fish Program, ready to walk us through the briefing briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Craig Burley, Fish Management Division Manager. And today I would like to talk with you about the sport fishing rule proposals for 2013-2014. And what I'd like to do is briefly talk about the new web-based process that we've been using this year, the timeline and public involvement that's been undertaken, and then touch briefly on what I'm calling popular topics, those topics that we've heard quite a bit of written comment about, and then really leave the majority of the time today for public comment. So this year, we used a web-based process for our sport rule proposals, both for soliciting proposals from the public as well as receiving comment from the public. And the intent here was twofold, to increase transparency as well as efficiency within the agency and working through this process. In the April through June time period, we accepted proposals from the public and staff. We received about 300 proposals. Staff reviewed those, and we submitted 69 proposals that we recommended for further consideration. We went out for public comment on those rules starting in September, and that extended through the end of January. We also held six public meetings throughout the state during the October-November time period. And as a result, we received over 2,300 public comments through our online system. We also did receive a number of proposals either via email or letter, and we've provided those online for public review as well. Those are as PDF files at the end of each of those proposals. So the public as well as the commission should be able to see each and every comment that we received on all proposals to date. I briefed you in detail in January on the proposals, and today we'll just highlight a few proposals that we've received a bit of comment on, and then move into the public hearing. So popular topics that we've seen a lot of comment on are statewide fishing closure for sharks in our state waters. Another is removal of the size and daily limits for bass, walleye, and channel catfish in Columbia River, Snake River, and tributaries. We've identified the specific areas in our package, received about 259 comments on that proposal. Proposal 15 is liberalizing bag limits for walleye in Lake Roosevelt and the Spokane Arm. About 126 comments there. Cabazon minimum size limit requirements go into an 18-inch minimum size limit. Our proposal on rockfish species retention in Marine Area 4, as well as a proposal to reduce the daily limit on select species of tuna. And then two additional proposals, reducing the lingcod minimum size in Marine Area 4 and reducing lingcod seasons in Marine Area 4B. So those were the proposals that we had submitted for public comment that we received quite a bit of testimony on through our written online process, and I'd like to walk through those. Closure for these species of sharks. We received some support for these proposals. People felt, given the life history of these species, that it warranted that closure, as well as there were concerns expressed for impacts of those shark species from fishing. We heard comments opposing this regulation, that there wasn't a large number of people fishing for these sharks, so that the impact would be minimum. There was comments that we lacked data to support this closure, and we also heard comments that people recommended a catch and release only fishery that would allow for data collection for these species.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Should we comment on these as we go, Craig, or does it?
Commissioner Duvia, I have provided some time at the end for questions, but I would, whatever the commission prefers.
I think it would be better to comment at the end.
Fine.
And I was also going to ask the commission to consider the fact that this is the public hearing, so we want to be sure to make enough time. There have been quite a few people who have signed up to testify. That's the important thing we're doing today, is to hear from the public. So we will have another opportunity when we make the decision to have more detailed discussions among ourselves. But so let's wait till after
the
presentation.
Thank you, Commissioners, Madam Chair. So the next proposal that I wanted to talk about was number 9, and this is removing or modifying size and daily limits for bass, walleye, and channel catfish in the Columbia River, Snake River, and tributaries. And this proposal has two options. Option 1, removing the size and daily limits for these species. Option 2 is no minimum or no daily limit, but having upper size limits for those species. Relative to option 1, we heard a lot of support for this relative to the conservation benefits associated with salmon and steelhead recovery. We did hear there were recommendations to expand this more broadly in the Columbia River below the Oregon-Washington border. We also received a number of proposals in, or comments in writing from National Marine Fisheries Service, the Washington Northwest Power and Conservation Council members, PUDs, treaty tribes, and some of our recovery boards in support of this option. And all of those letters are also included online in the comments. Relative to option 2, placing an upper size limit on these species, we did hear quite a bit of testimony that this would ensure that those populations would not be eliminated, but would provide some protection for those species and maintain quality fisheries. We did hear a number of comments, or read a number of comments, that opposed this proposal, both options, and there were concerns expressed for impacts to the local economy from the loss of a valuable fishery. They disagreed in part because these fish predators also eat northern pike minnow, which is a demonstrated predator for juvenile salmonids as well. And then finally, anglers, some indicate that these anglers seldom catch the limits now, and so this would not necessarily provide a benefit. Proposal number 15 is relative to liberalizing bag limits for walleye on Lake Roosevelt and the Spokane Arm. There were four options here, ranging from the current regulations to no regulations on daily limit or size for walleye. Most of the comments that we received were around option 3, which is the 16 fish limit with 1 over 22, or option 4. Support for option 3 centered around this protecting the larger broodstock walleye in the population and maintaining a quality fishery for those walleye. Support for option 4 was really focused on the benefits of recovering native fish populations, and this would be a quicker way to reduce large numbers of walleye in the reservoir. Number 65, relative to Cabazon minimum size requirements, the proposal is to implement an 18-inch minimum size. We heard support for this proposal in that it would increase the numbers of Cabazon and Puget Sound. We also heard recommendations or comments that we should reduce the season length in Puget Sound as well as reducing the daily limit to one Cabazon in Puget Sound. Comments we received in opposition to this were centered around comments saying that this was not necessary in Marine Area 4, that there was a good numbers of Cabazon there, that the department lacked good data to support this change, and that there was a concern for continued loss of marine fish opportunity, particularly expressed in the Nea Bay area. Number 66, this is relative to rockfish species retention in Marine Area 4. This is west of the Manila Tatoosh line, and this is the proposal is to allow retention of blue, black, and yellow tail rockfish. And we heard some support for this relative to providing additional protection for the non-retention species. We also heard opposition that there's healthy abundance of rockfish in this area, that there is already protection with a 20-fathom restrictions for a portion of the year, that there was lack of data to support this rule, and that our 2011 test fishery indicated large amounts of rockfish. Number 67 is the tuna daily limit. Here the proposal was a two fish daily limit for yellowfin skipjack and northern bluefin tuna. We heard comments in support for this proposal that it would it's sufficient to have a two fish daily limit for these species of tuna. We did hear opposition that there was no need to set the limit at this time, that these populations are healthy, that regulations aren't needed as these species are rarely caught. And we also heard that there was a support for further regulating the commercial catch instead of the recreational catch. Number 68, reducing lingcod minimum size in Marine Area 4. The proposal is to align this with Marine Areas 1 through 3 with a 22-inch minimum size. We heard support for this proposal that the lingcod populations are healthy there, that this would reduce bycatch of other species in the area. Comments in opposition were that this wouldn't be healthy for the lingcod population, that there could potentially be too many harvested. Also, people expressed the point of view that 22-inch is too small, and there's not enough meat on a 22-inch lingcod, and probably wasn't appropriate. There also was comments made that by in order to protect rockfish, that the focus should be on larger lingcod. Finally, Rule 69, reduced lingcod seasons in Marine Area 4B. Currently, the season is an April through October season. This would reduce that to a May 1 through June 15 season. Comments in support were this would reduce bycatch of rockfish species in the area, and that was necessary for rockfish protection. Comments in opposition indicated that there's plenty of lingcod for the current season, and it wasn't necessary from a lingcod perspective to reduce the season. And also there was a there were comments made that more lingcod in these areas would mean less rockfish due to lingcod predation on rockfish. In addition to the 69 proposals that we went out for public comment on, we also placed the remainder of the proposals that we did not recommend go forward for further consideration, and we did receive quite a bit of comment on a number of those, and I wanted to highlight three here for you. One is the Natchez River. There were a number of proposals proposing catch and release season. There was a regulation for Lake 16 looking for a quality fishing, quality fishery. And the third area was relative to the North Coast Steelhead, the Ho-Suldah, Kalau, and Bogoshiel Rivers. And so I wanted to touch on those just briefly. For the Natchez River, the proposal was to expand the current catch-and-release fishery that occurs in the middle section of the river to the entire river. Yeah, we heard a comment supporting this proposal that this would create additional quality fishing experience for wild trout, that it would provide conservation for wild juvenile salmonids, and it would result in an economic benefit with increased angler participating in a catch-and-release fishery. Comments in opposition to this were that there's not currently a conservation issue that would require this, that it could result in a decrease of angler participation, moving away from anglers that were interested in retaining a trout, and that people should be allowed to keep trout in those portions that are currently open for that. The regulation proposal we received for Lake 16 in Skagit County, this was really to address another lake that's in our proposal package, Evie Lake, that we've lost public access for. It's a quality water, and people were looking for an alternative for that fishing experience. The Lake 16 is currently an opening day water in that area and has quite a bit of opportunity or use on opening day. And so in support, we heard people interested in a quality fishing experience there. In opposition, we heard support for a continued opening day fishery and to maintain that opportunity. And then finally, there were several proposals received relative to the North Coast area, relative to Steelhead, and we received proposals relative to no fishing from floating devices in sections of the Ho, the Suldah, Kalau, and Bogoshiel Rivers. And we received comments supporting that, indicating that would protect spawning steelhead in these areas by creating refugia, that it's not acceptable to allow drift boats to effectively or be as effective as they are harvesting fish in these stretches of the river. In opposition, we heard that this would unnecessarily limit angler diversity and that not everyone can access these areas by foot, and so it would limit participation. So with that, what I wanted to do was just highlight some of the proposals that we received the most comment on and receive and reserve the rest of the time for public testimony. We have a lot of folks here to provide comment. We will be bringing recommendations to the commission at the March 1-2 commission meeting, and with an intent to have a May 1 pamphlet take effect. And with that, I'd take any questions.
Okay, questions? All right, everyone is looking forward to hearing from the public. Thank you.
Thank you.
But before we call the public up, we have some guests, some distinguished guests from the Colville tribe. I wanted to ask them to come forward. Darlene Zuckerle, who's the Colville tribe business council member, Brett Nine, resident fish program manager, and Holly McClellan, resident fish subdivision lead. And they have kindly agreed to provide the tribal perspective on some of the rules that are before us. They asked for this opportunity to speak to the commission. And because they are our co-managers, we wanted to give them a separate opportunity to bring their issues forward. So, welcome.
So, yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Commission. We appreciate the opportunity to present our information to you guys in support of a specific proposal number 15 on walleye in Lake Roosevelt. I've asked Holly McClellan, project biologist, to develop a technical presentation for you guys today on the impacts of walleye on our native fish. And then Council Member Darlene Zachary is going to present on the cultural perspective and the importance of native fishes to the Colville members. At the end of that, I'd like to address one small sturgeon issue at the end, and just a discussion point.
Okay.
So I'll pass this on to Holly, and she will present on the technical aspects of walleye.
Good afternoon. Thank you. So today I prepared a short presentation for you, about 9 slides, to give you a perspective of walleye in Lake Roosevelt, some of the issues we have to deal with, and then so you can maybe understand why we're trying to do the things we're doing. A little background. Lake Roosevelt, created in 1939, it's behind Grand Coulee Dam, extends 243 kilometers to the Canadian border. The Sampoil River runs it through the Colville Tribe Reservation, highlighted in orange there. And it's home to, there's native kokanee, red band trout Grand Coulee Dam was created in 1939, native fish persisted in the reservoir, which included kokanee, red band trout, and sturgeon. The Sampoil River runs the Colville Reservation. There's wild kokanee that used to run up the Sampoil River there, and those runs have been depleted, and returns are about 10 fish per year right now. And so we have a BPA-funded project that focuses on restoring that kokanee population in the Sampoil River. The Sampoil River is also home to native lacustrian red band rainbow trout, and that means they live in the reservoir and they run up the river to spawn. About a third way up the reservoir is the Spokane River, and it's surrounded by the Spokane Tribe Reservation in blue. On that reservation, there's also some wild trout populations that are persisting, and the Spokane Tribe are leading up the hatchery kokanee and rainbow trout mitigation projects that happen on the reservoir. Further up in the upper Columbia, the Colville River runs in, and the Kettle River is home to also native red band trout populations. And also in the upper Columbia, we have a white sturgeon population. So walleye in Lake Roosevelt. Walleye were illegally introduced in the 1950s above Little Falls Dam, which is on the Spokane River. In April and May, they congregate below Little Falls Dam, and that is where they spawn. It's the only spawning location that we know of in Lake Roosevelt, and they spawn between April and May. So since the 1980s, the entire Spokane River from where it connects to the Columbia River has been closed to fishing during the spawning period. So that's April, May. After spawning, the walleye distribute throughout the reservoir, and some of them stay in the Spokane River, some of them go to the lower parts of the reservoir, the Sampoil River, and then others distribute middle reservoir, and there's fisheries for them up by Kettle Falls and all the way up into the Northport area where the white sturgeon are. For angler pressure, the rainbow trout are the primary economic driver in Lake Roosevelt. 51% of almost 3,000 anglers interviewed are targeting rainbow trout. 35% were targeting walleye, 17% smallmouth bass, and 15% kokanee. When you break that down by the different sections of the reservoir, the lower section by the Sampoil River, anglers are mostly targeting rainbow trout. This is an average over the whole year. So 73% of all the anglers were targeting rainbow in the lower reservoir, and only 19 for walleye. In the middle reservoir, it's a combination of those numbers. And then with the most pressure for walleye up in the upper areas by the Colville River and north. And so as you can see, the rainbow trout were only targeted by 19% of the anglers. So the problem is the native fish populations have been declining since the 1960s, including the wild kokanee that I talked to you about in the Sampoil River, as well as our wild red band trout. Predation has been identified as an issue for hatchery and kokanee since the early 2000s in a variety of predation studies. So the Colville Tribe has invested millions of dollars on research and habitat improvements in the Sampoil River and its drainages to conserve and protect those red band trout and kokanee for the tribal members and recreational fisheries. So in 2010, the Colville Tribe teamed with Eastern Washington University to develop a bioenergetics model to determine how much walleye we're consuming of our kokanee and red band rainbow trout coming out of Sampoil. Because we use stocking to try and restore the kokanee population, so we're stocking both fry and yearling kokanee as well as eggs, kokanee eggs. In this study, they found that walleye and smallmouth bass were consuming 61% of all the kokanee fry we were stocking. They're consuming 32% of all the kokanee yearlings and 37 to 54% of all the wild red band trout yearlings out migrating out of the Sampoil River. So these values were, these consumption values are hindering our restoration activities for both kokanee and red band trout. The top picture is a medium-sized walleye that had over 50 kokanee fry in its gut, and the bottom picture is a kokanee yearling that was pumped out of a walleye. White sturgeon population is experiencing persistent recruitment failure. They are part of an international recovery effort, and they're listed as endangered in the British Columbia and the Canada, the SARA Act. Lab and field studies have found walleye to consume the larval and juvenile sturgeon. The top picture is of a walleye that consumed a wild sturgeon juvenile near Northport and then upper sections of the reservoir. And then lab studies conducted by Eastern Washington University also found that walleye will consume juvenile sturgeon when given the opportunity. So we realize predation is not the only problem for fishes in Lake Roosevelt, but we do know it's one of the major ones. So to deal with our particular issue in the Sampoil River, the Colville Tribe implemented a non-native predator reduction program in 2011 and 12, where we gill net and electrofish and to remove the walleye and smallmouth bass. We removed a little over 2,000 walleye, which is about 10% of the walleye population in the Sampoil River. Our goal is to reduce up to 50% of those. Our goal is to increase survival of our out-migrating juveniles. And we know that this method alone will not be effective because we just cannot get our hands on enough fish, and we need harvest as one of our management tools. So in 2012, we worked with the co-managers of Lake Roosevelt, and we changed the harvest regulation in the Sampoil River to open it up during that spawning run period. It was open from April to January. We kept the 8 fish limit, which it was on Lake Roosevelt, but we had no size restriction. There's currently a size restriction of 1 over 22. So what not changed was opening up the, or Lake Roosevelt in general, fishing regulations were not changed, so that closure was still enacted on the Spokane River. And locally, we have support with the co-managers of Lake Roosevelt to reduce the non-native predators to help conserve and protect our smallmouth stocks. So walleye management Lake Roosevelt, FWIN, which is the Fall Walleye Index Netting, you might be familiar with that, has indicated that there's been an increase in abundance in walleye from 2 to 6 fish per net. The condition of walleye has decreased, and it's the lowest in the area of walleye waters, with its condition factor of 0.79, and it should be closer to 1. As you can see in that picture, that walleye is more on the thin side of a walleye. Our creel survey estimates indicate that we harvest, that on Lake Roosevelt, anglers harvest about 50,000 walleye a year. Anglers, on average, over the whole year, are harvesting about 2.5 fish per trip. And then WDFW did a variety of modeling to look at this problem, and that's called the FAST modeling. And in that model, they said that we need to harvest 150,000 walleye before we can begin to reduce the population. So that brings us to where we are today to look at harvest regulations. And the ones that were proposed all include opening the Spokane River to harvest during the spawning run. And then the 4 options that were presented earlier are the 8 fish limit with 1 over 22, which is the current. Then the 16 fish limit was proposed, 16 fish limit with only 1 over 22, or then the no regulation or daily limit. And that's the particular regulation we support. And why does the Colville Tribe support this regulation? So the Colville Tribe prefers to use angler harvest as a management tool to balance walleye populations with native species instead of our mechanical removal. The 8 fish limit, or the status quo, the current, during all the modeling efforts, said we won't even approach the 150,000 fish needed. The 16 fish limit, the modeling indicated it'd have a twofold increase in harvest. That's 100,000 fish, but still 50,000 fish short of our target before we begin to reduce the walleye population. And then the 16 fish limit of 1 over 2 has the same issues as above, but it's confounded by not taking those larger fish out. You reduce your ability to decrease the overall abundance because those large females are most fecund. So no regulation on daily size limit. The highest harvest potential is during those seasonal fisheries, so the spawning run, and then there's also a really big walleye fishery up by China Bend in June, where anglers can really target those fish and they can reach those limits. But during the rest of the year, the harvest is closer to that 2.5 fish per trip. So it's only during these certain periods when the fish are congregated can the anglers really get up to those 16, 25 fish a day, where what we need to be to reduce that population. So, and in addition, the rules of the no limit does not limit anglers to the two possession limit. So our issue with that is if they're anglers who come to Lake Roosevelt and camp for a week and they're only allowed to harvest two daily limits, which would be 32 fish, then that's a ceiling for their harvest that it's unintended harvest limit on them. And so if we have unlimited, they are able to be there for their entire week, fish every day, and take out as many as they can, and then go back. So our co-manager of Lake Roosevelt, we monitor the walleye population pretty heavily. So we do the FWIN every year, fall walleye index sampling, and we also perform intense creel survey throughout the whole reservoir. So we feel that we have the ability to manage the walleye population. We'll know if the trends are up and down, or we'll know if our estimates for the fast modeling are accurate. And if they prove to be inaccurate, we'll be able to change quickly to address any of the issues. And with that, that's my short presentation. Sorry. Any questions?
Questions? Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Very nicely done. That was very informative. In the upper river, the water pull down has a major impact on the trout numbers as well as the food supply. Down at the sand poil, what is the impact of the water pull downs? From Grand Coulee.
Flow?
Yeah.
So in the lower reservoir, it's more like a lake, and it's deeper down there, but the flows are very fast, so water retention can be as low as 20 days through that whole entire reservoir and during runoff. So we do have flow issues. So yes. So on high flow years, we lose most of our hatchery fish. There's just not much we can do about that, yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Very good.
Yeah. I just wanted to give a short presentation on a little bit of the cultural aspect. My name is Darlene Zacherly, and I've lived in Washington State throughout most of my life, except leaving for short stints for my schooling. Currently, I am a council member from the Keller District, which is at the top of the San Poyle River. I grew up fishing. I learned how to fish as a small child, standing on the banks with my siblings and cousins. 1988, I went to work at Roosevelt Recreational Enterprises, where we had the houseboats. Okay, so there I got to know the local fishermen who would moor their boats at our facility, and I learned how to the troll fishing, the leaded line, which lures to use, where the fish were hitting. So I learned another aspect of fishing besides just fishing from the creek beds and the shorelines. So my concern is with the excess numbers of walleye that are eating our trout and the kokanee, they're not able to make it up to our smaller streams that run throughout the reservation. Because of the economic depression, which is going on everywhere, but mainly so in the timber industries where I currently reside, the unemployment rates are high. And these native fish actually supplement people, you know, in their household incomes when they need to put food on the table. So I am really concerned about the overzealous walleye in the San Poyle arm. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Brad?
So one last thing. The Colville tribe and also the Yakima tribe has developed contracts with Douglas PUD in hopes to supplement, or we are going to supplement, white sturgeon in the Wells Pool. Currently, the Wells Pool has roughly 30 sturgeon in it right now. And with the addition of the supplementation effort, we'd like to provide more protections for those sturgeons. Currently, the state reg is a catch-and-release fishery. We'd like to see that as a closed fishery. The Colville Tribe has implemented no fishing for sturgeon in their regulations, so we'd like to be parallel with the state if we could. So that may be a topic for next year. I don't know what you can do about it this year, but just wanted to put that in your ear.
Okay. Before you...
One other thing I just remembered, I know the state regulations on Lake Roosevelt are, there is a catch limit, but if at all possible, I would like to see the sampoil and a no-limit catch. Thank you.
Thanks. Commissioner Schmidt?
Thank you, Chair, and let me also thank Colville Tribe, especially the chairwoman, for being here today. It's rare that we have a chance to exchange like this, and it's very, very helpful. On sturgeon, concerning sturgeon conservation, I think you're talking to a group of people that are very supportive of that. And my question, it seems like you're focusing on Wells Pool. Have you thought about expanding that, say, from Chief Joe down to Rock Island?
Well, we would be in support of that, but unfortunately, we're only a co-manager on the Wells Pool, so that would be up to...
You mentioned the Yakima.
I think the Yakimas would probably, and the state obviously would be interested in that. But.
And you did make a key point. Through our regulatory process, we accept concepts and ideas, and we work on them through the public for probably 3 months now. So I'm not sure how we do this, but I can tell you there's a lot of sympathetic ears when it comes to doing something for sturgeon right now, and I appreciate your comments on the walleye as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you for
asking to come and talk with us. Terrific. And one more, we have another person who is representing the Makah Tribal Council, Robert Buckingham. Are you out there? Yeah, you want to come forward since you're representing the Makah Tribe? We'll let you have an opportunity that's somewhat separate to testify.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Commission. Director and Deputy Director. My name is Robert Buckingham. I'm the Port Director for the Port of Nebe, and the Makah Tribal Council asked me to provide public comment here during here that was submitted on behalf of the Makah Tribe in opposition to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife's proposed rule change number 69. I won't take the time to read the entire document, because I think you've got a copy of it all. But I would like to read the opening paragraph that touches on most of the five key concerns that are explained within the document in more detail. This is a public comment in opposition to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife proposed rule change number 69. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife proposed rule change number 69 would reduce the sport lingcod fishing season in Marine Area 4B by 134 days from the current season of April 16th through October 13th to the proposed season of May 1st through June 15th. This dramatic reduction is allegedly designed to conserve rockfish. However, it is not justified by the study on which it is based, may not result in the desired rockfish savings, and may, to the contrary, result in increased lingcod predation on rockfish and would cause severe economic hardships to the individuals and businesses in Nebe, Colombay, and CQ. For these reasons, the Makah Tribal Council strongly opposes this proposed rule change and supports the continuation of the status quo in the Marine Area 4B lingcod fishery. It does go on to identify five main concerns, and signed by sincerely Timothy Green Sr., Macaw Tribal Chairman.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the opportunity to address you.
Yes, we did get copies of that letter, and we will be handing out to all commissioners all of the materials that people want us to see today. So that will be distributed.
Okay, thanks so much for this opportunity.
Great. Okay, now we can listen to the public. We've got roughly 25 people who've signed up. Looks like one person signed up twice. That doesn't mean you get more than...
There's
two people by the same name. The commission rules are that you are allowed 3 minutes each, and we'd like you to come forward. I'll call you two at a time. We'd like you to come forward to the front table, speak into the mic, and then when you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up, and we would like you to conclude your remarks. And if you don't, I'll politely interrupt you, and then I'll get not so polite. So we'll start off with Ron Garner and Michael Jamberitz. You'd come forward, please.
Director, Deputy Director, Madam Chair, Commissioners, and Vice Chair, thanks today for taking the time to hear us and taking your own personal time to be here. So we really appreciate that. I handed you out some handouts of some rockfish that you've seen, and on the back, that's a rockfish identification guide. I'm working with Heather Reed of your department to try and help with rockfish identification and fish descender devices. I think this is going to be a way that we're going to start recovering our fisheries, and at the same time, I'm on the NOAA rockfish group, and I'm one of the only fishermen on there that there's a lot of times that reality doesn't really get brought into a lot of things that happen. There's a lot of emotional and citizen-based science that's brought up, and I kind of feel it's my job to discredit it where discredit is needed. And some of these things that we're looking at are some of these proposals. Number 66, rockfish species retention in Nia Bay. The Puget Sound Angler 17 chapter strongly opposes this, as these are our fishing grounds. We work out there a lot with a lot of our groups, and we help with a lot of different setting the seasons. I've been doing that since, 90s. Anyway, one of the main parts of that is some of the data that was used to come up with this is, if I know every one of you has seen this, and I sent some letters in, the 35 rockfish caught for one lingcod or cabazon in the 20-something can't be used. Mainly for the simple fact that when you want to catch a lingcod, you use something really big like this. You don't go, and this is what you use for your rockfish, which they're feeding off of small shrimp. So I would suggest, if you wouldn't mind, you call in your test boat, your rockfish test boat captains and fishermen, which I've talked to, I think all of them, and they agree that that you have to fish totally different to target a certain species. And using just taking data and pulling out that so many rockfish were caught for so many lingcod or cabazon is not using good science. So I want to make sure that, everybody's background here sitting at this table has vast background of making sure that actual science is used in making these kind of decisions. And I'm sure it'll be used here. The cabazon, I can understand. They're not a commonly caught fish because they eat crustaceans. You're never really going to catch them, but talking with Heather, there was kind of an uptick in some of them being caught. So I don't know. To me, that's not a big deal because I don't keep them anyway. But we have a lot of protection already out there on the 120-foot line. We have seasons on certain fish. But one of the main things we're having a problem with is yellow eye identification. A lot of people, with anything orange floating up there, is considered yellow eye. So I think that probably is good enough, and I'll let Mike take over from there.
Okay. And before that, Tom Burlingame, would you come forward? Okay, Mr. Jambritz.
Yeah, thank you for allowing the time for me to talk. Some of this is a repeat of what Ron said, but in regards to number 66, to match the limit of area 4A as that make it the same as 4B, I'm strongly opposed that. Well, by the way, I operate a charter vessel out there, so I make my living out there fishing, and very familiar with and have lots of friends in the hotel industry and resorts and whatnot. And any changes where we're going to lose opportunity is going to affect everybody in a negative way. If the reason is for conservation to make Area 4 the same as 4B, I can attest to the fact that there's plenty of rockfish in Area 4. We have no problem finding limits, and if it's about incidental catch of illegal fish or protected species, anytime we find something like that, if we catch one or two, one, it's not a huge issue, but if we catch like more than one, we're just going to pick up and move our boat so that we're not hitting those species. If the reason to change to match the limit with 4B is for if it's for enforcement, I could understand that for enforcement, just to make blacks and blues only, but the demarcation line of Tatoos to Panila line has worked for other fisheries for years. I don't see any problem with that. As long as somebody's not stopping and fishing in Area 4B, everything seems to work fine. Real quick, number 68, to reduce the minimum size of a ling cod, I oppose that as well. I think that a 22-inch fish is ridiculously small. The ling cod seem to be very abundant out there, and I don't see any reason to have to take a small fish in general, okay? And the fish are just in healthy numbers everywhere I've experienced. Real quick, number 69, to reduce the ling cod season. That was pretty well covered by the macaw tribe, but it's a huge economic change if we were to reduce the season to that small little period. If it's for retention of ling cod, if it's harming the rockfish population, once again, as Ron showed in his gear selection, if you don't want to catch a ling cod, just fish small gear. If you want to catch a ling cod, you fish the big gear, and the rockfish don't bite. You know, it's just kind of most people that fish know that. So I don't think it's an issue. So there's plenty of fish in Area 4B. Probably a little less than the ocean, but you know, there's still plenty for everybody. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. We've got a lot of people who have signed up. Okay, well, go ahead.
No, we can wait.
Okay.
My alarm didn't go off yet.
Now, or are you going to be here later?
I'm going to be here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Norm Reinhardt, would you please come forward? Okay, Mr. Burlingame.
Thank you for hearing us today, Director, Deputy Director, and Commissioners. I am Tom Burlingame. I'm owner of XL Fishing Charters. We operate out of Nia Bay. I also have purchased the Kingfisher Inn in Nia Bay, and we're going to be opening it up this summer for guests. I'd like to comment on some of the proposals in that area. Proposal number 66, I strongly disagree with. The two areas are uniquely different areas, 4 and 4B. The line in between them is clear. It's clearer than most of the lines in the other regulation areas in the saltwater in the state. So there shouldn't be any confusion as far as where you're fishing out there. There's healthy populations of these rockfish, and there's no need to have a closure on a healthy populations of China rockfish, quillback rockfish, copper rockfish, and so on. This proposal would have a real negative impact on the community, because if you were to make drastic changes there at Nia Bay, the fishers would just go to other ports, and and our populations of rockfish, I feel, are as healthy as anywhere on the coast in Area 4, and so I don't see the need for the change. Proposal number 68 to reduce the lane cod, I also oppose that one. 22-inch fish, folks, is just a small fish. We don't need to be keeping fish like that. We have a quality lane cod fishery in the bay. And to start keeping 22-inch fish pretty soon, all you're going to catch is 22-inch fish. Let's leave the size limit. I'd love to see it go up. Let's see the size limit remain at 24 inches, and let's keep a quality fishery. Proposal number 69, I also oppose. Shortening the lane cod season is not a necessary thing. As you've already heard from the previous speakers, the study that was used, the rockfish study information that was used, I believe was misinterpreted or twisted a little bit to make it look like there's a lot of rockfish caught while fishing for lane cod. But as you've already heard, we don't fish lane cod that way with shrimp flies or our small jigs. We gear up. We want to catch quality fish. That's why we want to keep a quality fishery, and our populations are healthy enough for that. One thing I would like to add is I am a strong proponent of devices to release rockfish. I used the Sequalizer last summer on my boat. They work great. We need to make them mandatory. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Kelly Barnum. Okay, Mr. Reiner.
Director, Madam Chair, Honorable Commissioners. My name is Norman Reinhardt. I'm the president of the Kitsap Pogie Club. I have no business interest in fishing. I'm a recreationalist. I'd like to make comment specifically on item number 66, rockfish species retention in Marine Area 4 west of the Benalla Tatoosh line. We have adequate numbers of many species of rockfish west of that line. By limiting the catches to blue and black and yellowtail, are we being counterproductive in trying to preserve the effort we're making today on the ESA listed fish, canaries and yellow eye specifically? If we take the other rockfish that are not ESA listed and remove them from the targeting pool, we effectively are going to increase the dwell time of the recreational fishermen on the water. And when you increase the dwell time, you're going to increase the impact rate, or the, but we're going to increase the number of those ESA fish that we list and then float away. Do we really want to do that? I strongly oppose this based just on trying to preserve those ESA listed fish. In terms of lane cod, if the science, this is another proposal in here, I don't know whether it's 69, but the Macaw tribe has just testified. I would like to make further comment in that, for the same reasons, if we curtail the lane cod fishery within Puget Sound, and I'm talking about Areas 5 eastward, we're trying to use Area 4 and the ocean to, as a pool, to put fish back into the straits, into Puget Sound. If we don't remove the predator fish, we're not going to have that occur. Those lane cod are going to be sitting there gobbling them up as they come down the straits. So to decrease that season again, are we really doing what we want to do in terms of those ESA listed fish? And it's my final point is just what the gentleman before me talked about. Currently, there's no requirement for a release device. We need to inform the public. I'm going to be doing that with my club. We're bringing the state in next month, I believe, to talk to us about the proper way to release these fish that are coming to the surface. We have to do something to encourage the public to get on board with that effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Greg Harris. Okay, Mr. Barnum?
All right, my name's Kelly Barnum. I'm the owner and operator of Seven Gill Outfitters. I'm here to talk to you about proposal number 4, the Seven Gill, Six Gill, and Thresher Shark Fishing Ban. First off, to give a little, the bordering states to us, Oregon and California. At this point, Oregon, for large pelagic migratory sharks, lists them at a 25 fish aggregate limit. So basically, you can take 25 fish, 25 seven gill, six gill, or thresher with any method. In California, they have a 1 fish per day daily limit with no size restrictions. What we're asking Washington to do at this point is to go to a catch and release only fishery with a circle hook restriction and a corrosive circle hook restriction so that we don't have stainless steel hooks left in the fish if you have to cut it. We tend to remove all the hooks out of the fish and release them. But if for some reason, due to people being concerned with safety of removing a hook from a large shark, we realize that some people will cut the line. So we would ask that it would be a corrosive circle hook. One of the other things that we want to talk about is this gives Washington State the chance to basically set the precedent to protect seven gill, six gill, and thresher sharks. We don't feel there should be a retention fishery on these fish. We think that the state should go to catch and release, allow fishermen to begin to collect data, and at that point, basically, we stop the harvest. So at this point, we have no population studies done whatsoever. We have no idea how many fish are coming into our estuaries. So this gives us a chance to stop the harvest, stop the killing, continue to collect data so that we can make the proper decision in the future. If it's 2 years down the road, 4 years down the line, we can decide what is the proper management tool for this species. So that's basically what we're asking the state to do, a catch and release, circle hook restriction, corrosive, and to leave the fish in the water, no removal of the species from the water.
Thank you. Okay, Al, I believe it's Sengel. Yes, okay. Mr. Harris?
Yes, my name is Greg Harris. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Shark Preservation Society. We are a new nonprofit formed this last year dedicated to studying and researching Northwest shark species with a current focus on the seven gill sharks. This past year, we started a population study doing mark and recapture, tagging, DNA sampling, measurements, girth, all of the fun stuff, trying to get a better picture of what's going on. In the future, we're planning on doing post-release mortality studies next season, along with some other things. I was going to address catch and release. I'm sure you're all aware of the benefits of a catch and release program. Being a new nonprofit with research funds being tight, to say the least, all of our support is coming from local fishermen. We're able to go out with local fishermen, fish for the sharks, and as they bring the sharks to the surface, we're able to take our data, do our measurements, do our taggings, and release the sharks back into the water. If the state is going to support a complete ban, we will be able to apply for a research permit to continue our research, but then all of the costs come directly onto us. That's basically my reason for wanting to support the catch and release. For the conservation aspect of it, personally, I'm happy that proactive steps are being taken to protect the species. I just think that it's premature without having any data to really support it. We just simply don't know. There's too many things up in the air that we don't know about these species. They're not very well studied. So that's basically what I wanted to just discuss briefly was, you know, giving us the chance, as Mr. Barnum said earlier, you know, complete the studies. If you know, a few years down the road, we are looking at populations and they need to be protected, you know, I'll be the first one sitting here saying, hey, we need to shut it down. So that was basically my points that I wanted to address.
Thank you. Wes Hoopler?
That's Al Senyo. Madam Chairman and Director Anderson and Commissioners, appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm president of the Steelhead Trout Club of Washington since its 84th year this year. Also, a very active member of the Menhow Valley Fly Fishers up in Winthrop. I have two concerns today. First, I want to talk about the rules process. And we're concerned that the Department of Fish and Wildlife rulemaking process is not being followed. Both rules, proposed rules that have been recommended for further comment by the department, and some that have not been recommended for further consideration, have been submitted directly to the Game Commission for further consideration. My question is the proper Department of Fish and Wildlife rule proposal process in place being followed? Do we have a level playing field? Are all the stakeholders playing by the same rules? Rules that have not been recommended for further consideration are now bypassing the Department of Fish and Wildlife rules process. Special interest groups are apparently being allowed to present their own rule proposals directly to the Game Commission for approval, a very dangerous precedent. We also have been advised that special interest groups arranged a conference call directly to the Game Commission or one of its subcommittees this week to discuss rule proposals that were not recommended for further comment. They are now resubmitting those to the Commission directly for further consideration. Something is not square here. We have a special interest group that is attempting to make rules that would tend to favor one particular user group over another. This process, at the very least, is decisive, pitting one group against the other. This is not a productive way to solve perceived issues. It would be better to focus on tribal gill nets, on getting timely signed tribal harvest agreements on the coastal rivers. They're still unsigned. They were due to be signed by the 1st of December. Let me change gears here. I'd like to talk about some of the regulation proposals that were not recommended by the Department of Fish and Wildlife for further consideration. No fishing from a floating device on the upper sections of many of the coastal rivers, the Hold, the Salduck, the Kalawa, the Bogashield, maybe other rivers as well, is particularly troubling. Selective gear rules, catch and release fishing with barbless hooks, wild fish not removed from the water are already in force on the upper sections of these rivers. The Department of Fish and Wildlife creel surveys confirm that on the Ho River, as an example, the oxbow. Am I out of business?
You can conclude your sentence there.
I'm here representing Meadow Valley fly fishers, and there is a rule proposal here, and maybe if there's time I can come back and explain that. There's some confusing language.
Okay, thank you. Chris Bellows. Hey, Mr. Hoopler.
Good afternoon. My name is Wes Hoppler. I'm a resident angler. I'm affiliated with Trout Unlimited, CCA, and the Steelhead Trout Club of Washington, but I speak for myself. I turned in some written comments here. I don't know if you have those, but I'm not going to list everything. I'm opposed to a number of restrictions on fishing from floating devices on upper sections of the Ho and Quilly River systems. I believe there's 10. I've listed them. Here's the deal. If there really is a vulnerable spawning populations being targeted and it's causing a conservation issue, exercise some stewardship and close those reaches. It just doesn't make sense to identify a vulnerable population and then earmark it for exploitation by a particular user group. Such proposals feel like a fisheries grab by people more interested in fishing than fish. Side note, I'm getting older and frankly, crawling in and out of a boat all day and during the winter just doesn't have a lot of appeal. On the Quileut system, sport anglers have never exceeded their harvest share, nor have they been the cause of a missed escapement goal. The wild winter runs in the Quileute are as healthy today as they were 30 years ago, almost to a fish on a five-year average in both run size and escapement. We've had major regulation changes for steelhead fisheries over the last 20 years, and they've paid some dividends to the fish. People need to get over citing past poor fisheries outcomes from 20 years as a basis for new restrictions. On the Ho River, sport angler impacts have exceeded their share of wild surplus in two of the last 15 years. Same cannot be said for other participants. However, management has improved significantly. The results have been two minor shortfalls of 6.5% in escapement, one escapement right on, and four escapements well over goal with an average of 38% surplus to the goal. Boat angling remains very popular in these stretches of river. On the Ho from Oxbow to the park, it's 62% of the anglers in the raw creel survey data are boat anglers. There is no trend in the rock reel data on the Ho to suggest that pressure is escalating. We desire inclusive regulations, not decisive regulations. And I kind of have three priorities I think should be pursued before we further restrict resident anglers. Work harder to see that the net sport angler surplus actually reaches the spawning grounds. Please, no more best purposes language about why that didn't happen. Eliminate non-resident guides from coastal wild steelhead fisheries. It's an issue with the co-managers and should be addressed. And if further reductions are required, eliminate harvest opportunities for non-resident anglers. I also oppose various wild steelhead release proposals that would impact Olympic Coast wild winter run fisheries. Basically, I believe that the rules serve a purpose in maintaining the rights of the state granted by the tribe, and I would like to see that continue.
Okay. Thank you. Rory O'Connor and Mr. Bellows.
Hi, I'm rule number 69, which is the Area 4B ling cod season restriction. I'd just like to make a point that I tend to be one of the most conservative when it comes to rockfish. I've written to the commission numerous times. I disagree with many of my fellow anglers on specific issues regarding rockfish inside the strait, and I am opposed to this rule. It makes no scientific sense, and just if we agree on this, it's obviously a bad proposal. I also wanted to mention that I support the rule that allows the retention of clipped hatchery fish below 14 inches on many of our coastal streams. We need to rid these rivers of residualized hatchery fish before they spawn with wild steelhead. I also wanted to mention rule number 51 and 58, which is increasing or creating trout seasons on Minter Creek and especially on the Quilcene River, are, in my opinion, insane at this time. It's a terrible idea, considering the stocks of steelhead, I'm sorry, resident rainbows, and also the sea run cutthroat fishery inside Hood Canal, which is a catch and release fishery that is a very popular fishery that these that the Quilcene would impact. And I also wanted to mention that I would like you to revisit some of the rules that were not given to you, and that involves lack of protection for steelhead and a lot in rule proposals that were not forwarded. I believe that bait bans need to be revisited. Bait kills juvenile smolts. It kills resident rainbows, which in many studies show up to 40% of the genetic makeup of steelhead come from resident species, and sea run cutthroat. Many bait cures are toxic, and release mortalities on adult steelhead are higher with bait. I believe that the no fishing from boat rules should be an important tool that the department uses. It creates sanctuary water, and it also reduces the efficiency of the sport fishing fleet without making people change how they fish. We're not talking about fly fishing only. We're not talking about banning certain techniques. You can do all of those from shore. And your own creel data has shown high catch rates, catch and release rates in both the Solduck and the Ho River, that we are starting to approach over, in some years, over 75% of the population is being caught and released. These fish do need some sanctuary water with it, and still finding a balance between creating that sanctuary water and also having sport fishing opportunity, which we all know we're losing with all the closures within Puget Sound, and we have to not manage these as bubbles where we're not taking into account pressure moving from other areas. Thank you.
Thank you. Eli Michael. Hey, Mr. O'Connor.
Yeah, thanks for holding the public forum. I'm here representing the Northwest Kayak Anglers. We ply Washington waters from essentially large pieces of Tupperware. And there's more of us than you think. I'm here to talk about how we oppose rule change 69, the shortening of the ling cod season. We're avid fishermen of Marine Area 4, specifically 4B, because of it offers us coastal grade fishing with protection from western wind and swell. And we go mostly in the summer and the late fall when the weather is moderated. And our chances for fishing would be significantly reduced with this rule change. It would honestly be devastating for us and for a lot of other anglers who fish from smaller craft. I mean, Nia Bay is heaven. It's sport fishing heaven for us. And in trying to understand how this proposal came about, we requested the data from WDFW, and we were told that the only data that is used in consideration of this proposal is the 2010 and 2011 dockside sampling program. Now, we've heard mention of a test fishery data, which is making preposterous claims like 35 rockfish to every one lingcod, and that is not being used in consideration. I just want to be absolutely clear. That's what we heard from WDFW multiple occasions. So we crunched the numbers on the dockside sampling, and we found it shows that there are 1.6 rockfish encountered for every legal lingcod caught. And the Puget Sound, WDFW's Puget Sound Rockfish Conservation Plan says that rockfish mortality is between 17 and 37% when the rockfish is caught in less than 120 feet. And we find that most rockfish are actually, or lingcod are caught in less than 80 feet, which gives rockfish an even better chance of living. So the numbers just don't show there's a lot of evidence that there's a worsening rockfish situation in 4B. So I'm really confused as how or why this was even introduced. So needless to say, we strongly oppose it. And like it was mentioned before, shortening the season would backfire, leaving larger predators in the water. They're just going to eat the rockfish and reduce the numbers. But there's a significant safety issue here, which hasn't been mentioned. A lot of smaller craft do fish 4B, and they're going to go out, and they're going to try to fish 4A when 4B is... if in the event this goes through, is closed. And that's going to create a safety issue for them and the people that have to come to their aid. Obviously, that's on them, but inevitably, people will do it. And not to mention, a lot of people just won't even go, which is, again, like the gentleman from the Makah tribe said, is a huge economic impact. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob Mulhauser?
My name's Eli Michael, and I'm a sports fisherman. I oppose the 69 proposal to shorten the lingcod season. I believe the numbers are strong, and if anything, it's going to negatively impact the bottom fish because they're apex predators. And as was previously mentioned, I really believe it could cause a health safety concern. For smaller boats, 2 years ago, I was in a boat that we did go offshore and it sank, so I could attest to that. And I really feel like it could have a very negative impact for the tribe. It would keep me from going out there and a lot of my friends, and that's a big part of the economy. I would say that the 120-foot rule helps quite a bit, and if you look at a chart of Area 4, it is true that a lot of the structure that you would fish for lingcod is up along the kelp beds, and a lot of, once you get out past 80 or 90 feet, it's a lot of sand anyway. You know, Wada Island, there's a bit of structure out deeper, but that, and then maybe more out towards Tattoos. I also do not support 66 to just keep the black, blue, and yellowtail. Oftentimes, the numbers of other rockfish we catch out there greatly surpasses the other rockfish. If you like to keep China rockfish, oftentimes I'd say we're catching 60 of them a day to try to catch some sea bass. So I think the bottom line is the more time you're spending fishing, the more time you're impacting, the more bycatch there is, even if the fish aren't having the, I lack of words for it, but there's got to be, you know, deep hooked fish and stuff too. I think the more bycatch, the worse the impact is, bottom line. Thank you.
Thank you. David Martin and Mr. Mulhauser.
Yeah, yes, excuse me. I'm here to speak of the seven gill shark. I fish for them. I do not fish for the other two species, but I can say I do harvest them. And I'm representing the Grace Harbor Poly Club and myself. And I'm opposed to closing it for the seven gills. And last summer, fishing for them, I seen all size range from small ones to ones over 9 feet long, and we release more than we catch. I mean, more than we keep. But I feel that it should be left open. And yes, study them, and you know, do some research. If there's a problem down the road, then yes, close it. But right now, if you close it, my grandson and I'll be dead and gone before it's ever open again. Thank you.
Thank you. Lawrence Buckland. Hey, Mr. Martin.
Madam Commissioner, Commissioners, Director and Assistant Deputy Director. My name is David Martin, and I'm the Region 4 WFD ADA committee member, and I'm affiliated with the Snow King PSA, but I'm here as a fisherman to tell you what I think. We've pretty much beaten Nia Bay to death. I'm not going to go into that. I'd like to talk about the shrimp real quick. I don't know if my pot puller will pull 200 shrimp out of 500 feet of water, but I'd certainly like to give it a try. And I don't want to pull up 200 shrimp and have to throw most of them back. I'd like to be able to keep it more than 80 shrimp. The other thing I was looking at is the anchovy and the sardine limit with the cast nets. If you leave out a La Push, there's really not a bait source. There's lots of bait out in the ocean, and it's easy to find. And having a cast net to go out and catch your own bait not only is a very economic opportunity for the fishermen, but it also allows us to fish out of other ports. I have a sequalizer descent device on my boat, and when we fished in the ocean last year, it works like a charm. It's more expensive than some of the simpler ones I've seen, but I think if the commission really wants to approach this rockfish issue, is requiring some sort of descent device on every boat that's fishing for rockfish or bottomfish would be an opportunity. We can require barbless hooks. We can require all kinds of different fishing gear. Here's an opportunity to make a real impact on what we do and how we do it. So I'll leave Nia Bay. That's already been beat to death. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Bob Margulis. Hey, Mr. Buckland.
Thank you. Thank you for having me represent Puget Sound Anglers Gig Harbor. Yes, we beat Nia Bay up, but I'm going to run through the list of pertinent to my members proposed regulation changes and maybe add a couple of other things. Number 63, yes on shrimp. Number 64, cast nets, yes. I'm just going to run through this for the record quickly. Cabazon size, number 65, no data support. Number 66, no on that. I've testified on these issues before, and I hate to admit in front of some of my friends and co-fishermen, I'm a puker. And I find being able to fish Nia Bay out to Tatoosh, a place that I can handle. If you force me to go out, I'll be miserable. And I'll think about you all every time. But in all seriousness, we'll go out and fish 4A if it's decent. But 4B also provides us an opportunity to fall back in. If we turn 4A into 4B with its restrictions unnecessarily without any supporting data, I'm afraid a lot of folks just won't make the trip up there. Tuna daily catch, no. And this kind of, I'm going to offer that this also kind of goes to the thresher shark aspect. We need to have some data that shows that these fish are actually in trouble in their normal range before we start to restrict daily catch. I mean, it's so problematic as to be able to run into them as they come through, depending on the water temperatures and all. if they happen to hit us, we have a good opportunity to catch them. If they don't come through that year, it's not because of their population. It's just because they didn't get here. 68, reduced ling size, no, for the reasons stated. Number 69, reduced ling season, no. And I would also add that I did the numbers on this, and that's a 75% reduction in opportunity. And what we've talked about here is opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. 15 days at the front end in April, and I fished that in April on great days, and 20 days in September, October, that also offers a fishery. But there's nothing else out there going on. So that's it. You shut it down, they're not going to have any activity at all. Gosh, I'm kind of at the end. Thresher shark, as I understand, is a pelagic species also, and it's also edible. So before you pass regulations on this, you might want to consider that thresher versus six-gill and seven-gill estuary-type fish. And finally, if I can touch on the issue of there were proposed regulations that were not recommended because there was no supporting data, that is, on rockfish out in the same area. And yet we have others that were submitted for consideration. And I'm confused, without any data, why do we have some that are coming forward and some that aren't? So that ends my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jim Schmitz. Okay, Mr. Margulis.
Madam Chair, Commissioners, Directors, I'm Bob Margulis. I'm the Executive Director of the Wild Steelhead Coalition. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you again today. And I'd like to start by emphasizing that the statewide steelhead management plan calls for the protection of natural production, which takes priority over opportunity. I don't expect that species conservation is going to win any popularity contests, and at the same time, bathing suit competitions are probably not the way to go about making decisions. So I'd like to talk about four of our not recommended proposals. They all relate to the increased pressure on the Olympic Peninsula for wild steelhead in the wintertime, and that's primarily the result of closures in Puget Sound, combined with a very, very significant influx of out-of-state guides, out-of-state anglers. Two of the four had to do with restrictions on fishing from floating devices. In one case, it's an area on the Ho where, from the little data that's available, it would appear that over a third of the spawning in the river takes place in that one section alone. I'm going to repeat a lot of what was said eloquently by someone earlier relative to sanctuary and some other things, but they do need sanctuary waters. This is not an inordinately large river in that area, and people fishing from the banks combined with people fishing from shore, particularly guides, who account for 90% of the catch, are just putting an inordinate amount of pressure, and was indicated earlier, about 75% or more of the fish are being handled, and it's just undue pressure on a fishery where the number of individuals has declined over the years. Also, selective gear rules on west side rivers. We've spoken previously about mortality rates due to the release, and then lastly, a mandatory hatchery steelhead retention statewide. We have it on the Upper Columbia River tributaries, and It's well documented that hatchery wild steelhead introgression has a negative impact on the wild fish populations. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Rich Sims, please come forward. Okay, Mr. Schmitz.
Thanks for giving me the time to speak here today. My name is Jim Schmitz. I'm a concerned angler from Tacoma, Washington, and I'm here to urge you to reconsider the change to selective gear for wild steelhead in all rivers in the state of Washington under DFW 725075. I believe right now we're at a crossroads in the state's efforts and attention on the future of all wild steelhead statewide. I honestly feel it's time that the commission really raised the bar to help protect these fish. The last time I checked, wild steelhead was our state fish adopted in 1969 by the legislature. Today, we're fortunate to have a number of top-notch scientists here in the Pacific Northwest that are furnishing, hopefully, everyone on the commission, a lot of good science and data and ideas, thinking outside the box and doing different things and trying different things to help protect wild steelhead. After reviewing all the comments, I was blown away this year by how many people, not so much that are represented here today, but how many people wrote in on behalf of the issues provided to the state or the comments provided regarding wild steelhead that were just pushed to the wayside. You know, now is the time. I really, really feel the state needs to make the extra effort and go the extra mile to really put some serious attention on wild steelhead. You know, if we can look at these selective gear regulations, you can see that it's going to happen on the Columbia River. The state of Oregon and Washington have come together and taken the, you know, challenge to do that. The last time I looked, our friends or neighbors up north in British Columbia have adopted a barbless hook rule on all freshwater streams in BC. It's just not rocket science, and it shouldn't be a political battle, because the one thing that matters the most is being forgotten. Steelhead populations are declining statewide, and that's a fact. If the commission can honestly sit back and not go the extra mile to protect these fish, I just want to urge you all to reconsider and think about all these regulations that were just pushed aside this year, and not give them an extra, just give them another look and really, really ask yourself, will this proposal attempt to help wild steelhead recovery? And unless we try it, we're not going to know. If the fish have to adapt, so do the anglers and the rules that we adopt to protect them. Don't knock until you try it. The state has some great scientists working here. We've got good science backing all this steelhead data. Not everyone's going to agree on all these issues. I just think, I don't want to be here 20 years from now sitting at this table asking you guys what we're going to rename our state fish. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Dan Stauffer. Okay, Mr. Sims.
Yes, thank you. The Olympic Peninsula is a special place with legendary steelhead. That's the good news. The bad news, with the age of instant media, compounded with many anglers compromised by closed streams searching for others, the fish are not getting a break. The problem is displaced anglers and increased interest in wild steelhead. Demand has exceeded the supply of wild steelhead in the places to angle for them. This results in an immense pressure on the fish, which historically are not going in the right direction. It seems as though our answer for steelhead recovery is reactive to manage by closure with little regards of impacts to rivers still open. The challenge is, how do we protect the resource while preserving angling opportunity? Our first priority is to protect wild steelhead, but also protecting the angling opportunities we have left. By doing now, we can divert the need to totally close down areas in the future. No one wins when the river is closed. This year, the WSC put forth some proactive proposals designed to provide relief for wild steelhead and preserve opportunity, which were turned down. Barbless hook and selective gear rules. The reason given for not adopting a broad regulation such as this unnecessarily limits fishing opportunity. It is clear that the best available science that the elimination of barbed hooks will greatly reduce catch and release mortality. BEC has a general barbless hook rule province-wide. Our saltwater fisheries have been barbless for salmon for 30 years, and recently our commission thankfully enacted a barbless rule for the Lower Columbia River. Mandatory retention of hatchery steelhead. The reason for not adopting this proposal would restrict options for catch and release fishing and would be very hard to enforce. The purpose for hatchery fish is for harvest. These fish should be harvested, not released back into the system to the detriment of wild steelhead. The science continues to clearly illustrate this. How much harder would it be to enforce than removing a fish from the water? Fishing from a floating device, not allowing the whole river. The reason for not adopting is typically not a tool used to address conservation objectives. Currently, wild steelhead are meeting escapement in the river. This is untrue. The Ho has been very inconsistent in meeting its spawning escapement. This section proposed is an extremely important area for holding and spawning for wild steelhead. This proposal will allow some refuge for the fish and continue providing opportunity. I'm extremely discouraged by the lack of consideration for many good proposals put forth that were proactive, providing some relief from unsustainable angling pressure. I ask the Commission to reconsider them. I would like to close with a quote from a conservation film made in 1968 regarding Pass Creek on Oregon's North Umpqua. When those rivers are destroyed, they can leave those and find others until the time comes for the fish and the fishermen when there is no place left to go. Please reflect on this quote as you make your decision, and thanks again for your opportunity.
Thank you. Philip or Philippe Gaiti?
Mr. Stauffer. Director, thank you for this opportunity once again. I want to comment for a few moments on all of the proposals for the Nea Bay 4B area, from the rockfish to the lingcod to the cabazon, and the importance of that area in our heritage for the average blue-collar small boater. We heard from the kayaker earlier, it's safe waters. My first experience in those waters was in 1976 in a 15-foot wooden boat. Not a vessel I'd care to be out in those waters in today, but we did it and we caught fish, and I'm still fishing these areas because of that. And as part of our heritage, I brought some of my library here today. Here is the 1952-53 Washington Fishing and Hunting Guide, all the way up to the 1978 Terry Sheely How to Fish Washington. CQ to Nea Bay is listed as that same mecca for all those decades, the place where the blue-collar angler can take their family and a small boat and have a world-class experience on a budget. And we just cannot afford to lose that part of what makes this state so special. And so from all those four proposals for 4B, I urge you to reject them and look at other reasons to keep the area open and how to save the fish with the rockfish descent devices. That funny little twisted piece of wire from Shelton is going to change a lot of things. It's simple and it's elegant, and it's going to keep these books being valuable resource tools instead of footnotes to history. Thank you.
Thank you. Jamie Glasgow and Mr. Gaiti.
Yes, thank you very much to let me speak at the committee, Madam Chairman. I am a resident and a fisherman of Washington since 1969. And I saw a big decline in drastic fishing opportunity. And I'm going to be brief. I joined Ron Garner and the Macau tribe on opposing all those from 65 to 69. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ken Townsend.
Commissioners. Director, thank you for the opportunity. Jamie Glasgow, Wild Fish Conservancy. I'm going to keep this short. Over the past hour, we've heard a lot about opportunity. And I'm glad we're all sitting down because I have some shocking news. Here in the state of Washington, we have populations of steelhead and rockfish that are listed as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act, or our state species of concern. I commend the department for proposing several unpopular in this room, but important conservation-based rule changes. These include 10 conservation-based steelhead proposals and 8 conservation-based rockfish and cabazon proposals. I'm not going to list them here because I've written you about them. These proposals are in direct keeping with written state policy to manage fisheries to protect the weakest stocks affected by those fisheries. We appreciate the department's efforts to collect groundfish encounter data in Area 4B. We hope these efforts will continue, and we expect that those data will be used to inform responsible fishing regulations that work to reduce encounters with non-target rockfish species. Thanks.
Thank you. Steve Watros.
My name's Ken Townsend. Thank you for the time. I'm here to speak in opposition of the rules change for floating the upper peninsula rivers, or fishing from a floating device, the upper peninsula rivers. Several people have spoken before me, done a very good job. I might add, on a common sense basis, where do you have to anchor a boat? You have to anchor in order to get in and out of it. You have to anchor the boat in the shallows on the gravel bars that are being used by the steelhead to spawn in. Your walking is going to take place when you're fishing from the bank in the gravel bars, usually waist deep or less, in the areas, upper river, low water conditions, where the steelhead spawn. Restricting the use of a floating device in the upper rivers of the peninsula is not going to do any good, in my opinion. Several years ago, actually quite a long time now, there used to be a wild steelhead retention of 10 fish per year. Then it was lowered to 5 fish. Guess what happened? The sport fishing community agreed with the lowering from 10 to 5. The runs continued to decline. The cure for that? Reduce the sport fishing catch from 5 to 1 for wild steelhead retention. The runs are continuing to decline. We lowered the annual retention from 5 fish to 1. The runs continue to decline, but the tribal fishing increased. I understand that there's 50%. That's not the issue. The issue is the style in which the tribal netting takes place. Okay? And one of the big problems is the sweep or drift netting for the lower hole, some sections of the Salt Duck River. And jet boats, they run up, they'll throw out a cast net, and they will literally sweep the entire hole. And they do this from the mouth of the river all the way up to the 101 bridge. And by the way, to reiterate, all of your hatchery or all of your native steelhead retention from the 101 bridge upriver is all single barbless state regulations and catch and release at this time, unless you happen to catch a stray hatchery fish. So you already have no bait, you have single barbless, you have all of those rules that are already in place for the upriver sections of the peninsula river. My last sentence, or my last paragraph. The revenue return to Washington State generated by the sport fishing community is substantial. Given the current state of the state, one would believe that instead of trying to reduce sport fishing opportunities, the state would be looking for ways to increase fishing opportunities to generate revenue through license sales, tackle sales, taxes, and everything else. Well, right now, the way things are going, what I have seen, and I am a lifetime resident of Washington State. I put my first steelhead on the beach in 1958. I've been here for a while. I've been at this for a while. And it just appears to me that this whole thing is going in the wrong direction. There's bigger fish to fry out there than fighting over whether you're going to have a floating device used or not, or whether you can fish from a floating device. Like I said, in order to get out of that drift boat in the upper river, you have to anchor in the shallows where the steelhead are going to spawn. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Marcos Lopez. Hey, Mr. Watrous.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Steve Watrous. I'm president of Columbia Pacific Anglers Association and the State Anadromous Advisory Committee, the Columbia River Advisory Committee, and for the past 21 years, I've held your Washington State Sport Rep seat on the Pacific Fishery Management Council's Salmon Advisory Subpanel. I am here today to speak in opposition to the proposed two fish annual bag limit for the sturgeon, which is being put forth as a conservation measure. It is not a conservation measure. If it was, I would be here today speaking in favor of it. Our groups and the Columbia River groups, the Clark County group specifically, were the first ones to come forward back in the early 80s asking for further protection of these fish, back when the department and the biologist felt that was unnecessary. So I assure you that anything that can save this wonderful fish is something that we really, really want. For the purposes of today, I will also be representing the Vancouver Wildlife League and the Ilwaco Charter Association, both of whom oppose this measure. By definition, a quota fishery sets a finite number of fish to be harvested, and the sturgeon fishery on the Columbia River is a quota fishery. No daily limit, weekly limit, annual bag limits will change the number of fish that will be harvested. So this proposal won't save one single fish or one single sturgeon. All of those fish will be harvested. But what this measure will do is it will reallocate fish from one user group to another. And what I don't quite understand is why we would propose this in Washington when we are in reality going to be reallocating fish from Washington anglers to Oregon anglers. And I suspect I'm going to see a couple of question marks popping out of the top of the heads up there. By limiting Joe Sixpack, the private boat angler, to one fish a year, you effectively lock him out of the fishery after one fish. It's going to be perceived as unfair, and it really is. And the reason for that is that they are shouldering an undue burden with this regulation, while the guides and the charter boat operators are allowed to continue to sell trips day after day after day after day, while Joe Sixpack puts his boat on the trailer and goes home. The vast majority of the guides on the Columbia River are Oregon guides. And that's due to Oregon's inability or maybe their unwillingness to put a cap on their guide licenses, which have seen a huge growth in guides on the Oregon side of the river over the last few years. In addition to that, in the estuary below Wauna, where 60% of the sturgeon quota is going to be harvested, Washington guides are not allowed to operate, only Oregon guides. So what we've done is we've taken a measure that we've proposed as a conservation measure, and which truly isn't, and we've created an allocation issue, which I think, didn't we just have something done with that, like a Kitzhaber thing or something just recently? And instead, we've created another allocation issue, and we have reallocated from one group to another and from one state to another. And I'm not really sure that's what we really want to do. This measure also...
Steve, excuse me. I don't think you heard the beeper.
Oh, I didn't. I'm a little hard of hearing.
Okay.
I'll wrap up then, but I would also like to add that this has been tried in the ocean and was abandoned as a complete failure. It didn't work. And also that it's unenforceable according to the enforcement people, and it promotes noncompliance. And thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay, Scott Cotell. You're the last one. Okay, Mr. Lopez.
Thank you very much. It's great to have the opportunity to speak with you. I'm a sportsman, not a commercial fisher. In fact, some people would say I'm not a sportsman fisherman. If you look at my shirt, not too many of them back there have button-down shirts on. But it is a very avid hobby of not only mine, but my wife, my daughter, my son. It is very much a family affair. And I would have to vouch my full support, my family support, against these policies, and we would support opposing 65, 66, 67, 68, and 69. I would have to say, since we moved to Washington more than 20 years ago, we have made annual trips to Nia Bay, CQ, out to fish in those regions. And contrary to belief, not everybody in Bellevue is rich, and even though they call it Hot Tub High, where I used to coach, is those boats that are smaller just cannot survive if they get out in the open water outside of into marine area, you know, into 4A. And related to fishing in 4A, I think the policy I'm most opposed to is the one for 69, is I believe if you've ever gone out there and fished with people that are knowledgeable how to fish that area, and if you don't know how to fish there, you're not going to catch really much of anything. But I can tell you that if you go fish with Mike, who was up here in the beginning, when you fish for lingcod, all you catch ever is lingcod, and because that's his business. And the people that are out there for the lingcod, they're in the zones and they're using techniques that's all they catch. You very rarely will see people lingcod fishing catching other things, because that's not what they're after. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Cotell.
Hello, my name is Scott Cotell. This is my first time ever testifying down here in Olympia. While I belong to several chapters of Puget Sound Anglers, I am here representing my family. Last year, I made a substantial investment in a larger boat so my family can safely fish the Nia Bay area for lingcod and rockfish. And it is something that we do several times a year for the past several years. So I hope that you take into consideration these lingcod reductions, bottom fish reductions, and keep the small boat fishermen in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, before I conclude this public input on this item, I want to clarify. I said at the beginning there was one person who seemed to have signed up twice, and that was Wes Hopler. I called your name Hoopler because one sign-up sheet said Hoopler, the other said Hopler. Are there two different people here?
There's one, ma'am. Stepped out of the room.
Okay, but there are not two different people. Okay, good. Then we can conclude the public input. Thanks for that. Do you want to, Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want a little bit of information, if I may. Mike, would it be appropriate if I called Mike back up for a moment?
Sure. Yeah, we have a few minutes.
Mike, good afternoon. I'd like to get a little bit of your personal anecdotal experience as it relates to number 67 and your knowledge of the impact of the general or average recreational fishermen on yellowfin, skipjack, and northern bluefin off the Washington coast. I don't know much about it, but I suspect you do.
I'm probably not the right person to ask about those fish, okay? We do very, very few trips out of Nia Bay for any tuna at all. It's available. We usually do it once a year just for our own personal meat. And it's all albacore. I mean, those fish that are in number 67, I've never heard of anybody catching one out of Area 4 ever, or Area 3, so I don't think it's really an issue. So
your colleagues, you've not heard?
No.
Okay.
I've heard of a bluefin tuna, and I think we had one on our boat one year that was very, very small. It's a little peanut, and, you know, but it's not a common thing to see.
Well, you're the best guy in the room to ask, I thought so. Thank you for your comments.
You bet.
Okay. Well, that concludes the public input on that item.